Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Women Askcast November Mailbag Edition with me, your host Tim Stillman, and as ever, co-host Alex Ibaceta. Alex, how are you doing?
Yeah, a bit tired, but good. I channeled my inner Kim Little in a cup quarterfinal the other day, so I was kind of proud of that. But yeah, tired.
the days of my inner Kim Little are very, very much behind me, I'm afraid.
No one needs to know that. Just live up to it, Tim.
So before we crack on with our usual monthly mailbag edition, and we've got loads of really, really good and varied questions as ever, but a lot of things I'm really keen to talk about, actually. Just to do some housekeeping off the bat, we're going to have three pods in 3 weeks, actually. So we've got this one, the November mailbag, coming out. And then on Wednesday next week, so I believe that's Wednesday the 1st of December, we're going to have an FA Cup final preview pod. We'll get a little bit of Chelsea perspective on that, but we also have exclusive interviews with Steph Catley and Noel Maritz for our FA Cup final preview pod. And then after that, on Tuesday the 7th of December, we'll have a Barcelona preview podcast. And that's going to feature Lotta Wubben-Moy, and that's another exclusive interview that we conducted at Emirates Stadium with Lotta. And we'll have a little look ahead to that Barcelona game, which obviously takes place at Emirates Stadium on Thursday, the 9th of December. Kickoff now moved to 7 p.m. And that's so that Arsenal don't get hit with a 10,000 cap on attendance, because West Ham and Spurs are playing in very minor European competitions at home that evening. So Arsenal will play in the Champions League against Barca on Thursday, the 9th of December, and we'll have a good look forward to that. So three podcasts coming up in 3 weeks. Very busy time for Arsenal, so very busy time for us too. But without further ado, let's get stuck into your questions for the November mailbag, and some really, really good ones. And like I said, a variety of subjects. And the first one I really, really like from House of Bucci at Laguna Beach on Twitter. And House of Bucci asks, is it time for the women to have their own kit design and shirt sponsors a la Las Chivas? Seems like they're lumping them in with the men. We're leaving money on the table as well as ignoring one of the team's strongest marketing avenues. Alex, what do you reckon to that?
Oh, that's a lot of money business that I don't know enough about to make an actual comment on it. But I do think it's interesting, because you can either have one kind of a uniform kit and sponsor in both, and then you can do another one like Barcelona, for example, who have the same kit but different sponsors, or you have Chivas who just have two completely different things. So I think it's a matter of the clubs and how much they want to commit. It's also a matter of how much these sponsorships will affect what the women's teams get. So if the main sponsor of the men's team is happy to take over the women's team and have that same, you know, give them enough money for it to be worth it, then by all means. But I think it's more a matter about the money than it is about the kind of visual aspect of things. Because it is, at the end of the day, it's one club mentality that a lot of people should have. So a same kit, same sponsor, isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's more about behind the scenes and how much this actually commits to the women's team and how much the women's team gets from an umbrella sponsor and all that stuff. So yeah, I think it's down to behind the scenes stuff, but I don't really see a problem with it. I think it's a individual club by club basis. And like I said, it's more about the money. As bad as that sounds, it is about the money and how much the women's team actually get out of it.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question, because you've hit on it there. There's two ways you can look at it. You can look at it as it's one club. They should all have like the same shirt, the same sponsorship. But at the same time, there is a set, like, where do you find that sweet spot between being one club but also marketing your women's team as something separate and interesting and empowering in its own right? I think a lot of it would depend on what's already in some of the kit and shirt sponsorship deals. So I don't really know what it would take, for example, because obviously the women's kind of kit is all factored into that. So I don't know what it would take to extricate. Let's say someone came along with some money and said, we just want to sponsor Arsenal women. Whether Arsenal would then have to pay a fee to extricate themselves or partially extricate themselves from the Fly Emirates sponsorship deal. Maybe it's something they can look at the next time the shirt sponsorship deals come up. Maybe it's there's a way of parceling them out. Manchester United, well, their men's team anyway, they kind of separate out like training kit and their shirt sponsors and things like that. So I think there are options perhaps for doing something like that. But I think what I'd definitely like to see, and I think we might see, I'd love to see Adidas, for example, get involved with something like this. And, you know, do like a particular like Arsenal women merchandise drop, you know, Adidas do several a season, or just to have more like dedicated Arsenal women merchandise in the club store. So a lot of people ask, you know, where can I get like an Arsenal women scarf? And the answer at the moment is you only get it in the membership pack if you're a member. But, you know, how can I get like a scarf or a hat that's just for Arsenal women, for example? And I agree, that's all that is just like a separate merchandise stream for you, basically, off the bat. And you can already see the number of people at games who customize their shirts with the WSL printing and the names and the WSL badges on the side and things like that. So, I mean, I guess that's a way of customizing your merchandise. But I think the shirt kind of sponsorship, I think that's an interesting one. And we've also seen initiatives like West Ham, for example, like in Breast Cancer Awareness Month, they tend to wear a pink away shirt. My Brazilian team, Atletico Mineiro, they did something like that recently. They had a pink away shirt, and they did this thing where they said that they got so many questions about it, and they said, if we get to 100,000 followers on Instagram by the end of the month, we'll release it for commercial sale. So like there's little kind of activations that you can do, and I would like to see a little bit more innovation in that space. I suspect we might, but we'll see. But I think that's a really good question, and I think a lot of it just comes down to if someone comes with enough money to do that, I think it would happen. And I'm old enough to remember when Arsenal ladies were sponsored by Daily Star while the Arsenal men were sponsored by JVC in the early 90s. So there is precedent for it. We've had some questions. I've grouped them together because they're all under a very similar theme, and one I'm pretty keen to talk about, actually. And really, I think we can kind of umbrella them as, is the kind of honeymoon period over for Jonas Eidevall? So Adam Salter at Adam Salter 4. With injuries starting to mount and Arsenal dropping points against Spurs, are we seeing the end of the Jonas honeymoon era? And Eileen at Eileen EST on Twitter, we have overperformed on our XG quite a lot this season, except the Spurs game, ironically. Do you think this can be sustainable in the long run, or is the quality of our chances something we should be worried about? And Highbury Librarian at N5 Librarian, given the expectation that other clubs will try to figure out a successful team, what signs can you see that other clubs are changing their approach by playing Arsenal women? And finally, at Ariel AWFC, very similar. I'm interested to know if you think the left-sided overload that we've seen a lot in recent games is something that teams will start to anticipate in the same way that they did Joe's tactics. So broadly, all of those questions, are Arsenal, after a really kind of promising start, being found out a little bit, maybe a little bit of fatigue showing? What do you reckon, Alex?
Yeah, I think we have to say it's a lot about fatigue at this point. We've mentioned, and you know, we've been saying it since the start of the season, that Jonas' style of play is a very high energetic, high press. You know, it's a lot of commitment that you need to keep this style of play up. And then, you know, with the scheduling and the Champions League games, you know, you have three games in a span of like 8 days or so. It's really hard to keep this up. Whether you're playing a high pressing, high energy style of play, it's going to be exhausting either way. Because on top of that, you have, you know, your other commitments, whether it be social, whether it be, you know, training, recovery, everything else that you have going on in life, it's going to be tiring at the end of the day. But I don't know if you can fit, because you could see, especially the left side, as you mentioned there, you know, our strength most of the time will be on the left side when you have Katie McCabe there, for example, when you have Beth Mead playing on that side. It also, you know, you have that strength. And then when you have, obviously, unfortunately, Leah Williamson is not here at the moment, but her style of play was always switching the field across to the left side, for example. So the left side is very, very heavily, you know, stacked in players. You have Steph Catley, you know, Katie McCabe, Beth Mead, for example, that like to play there. I would say those would be the main threatening players. But I think Arsenal have to take that next step now and kind of figure out how to keep this momentum up in the best way possible. And I mean that, and I don't like to make this comparison because it's so close to the game, but if you look at Barcelona, they are able to keep up a high intensity, good football, high scoring type of football consistently. And I think Arsenal need to do that too. And they have the players to do it. They have the style of play to do it. They have the manager to do it. It's just a matter of doing it. And it sounds a lot easier to say than done, obviously. But I think the honeymoon stage could be done. I think when we played against Curve, for example, we saw a lot of, it kind of looked like we were under Joe Montemurro again. And I mean that in the best way possible. We were controlling possession, we were controlling the ball, but we weren't just really penetrating any of the spaces that we were getting available to us, and we weren't taking any chances. Obviously, until the end, I think Frida Mannum was a big part of kind of sparking up that style of play again. But I think it's a matter of now of kind of, you know, maybe sitting down everyone and reminding them what the style of play, what the expectations are, and having them commit to that again, like they did in the beginning of the season. I think it's a matter of getting that same commitment and motivation and everything that started at the beginning of the season that started so well, refreshing that and continuing now. I think international break came at a good time for Arsenal. To kind of sit back and reflect on everything that's happened, because yeah, since the Spurs game, it hasn't been a nice watch in general. I think the Manchester United game for both sides, I think it was very underwhelming considering the match that it was supposed to be. Yeah, against Kerr, good game at the end, but a lot of the time it just felt like Arsenal were just tiredly moving the ball around without really getting to the goal. And I mean that like the actual goal of winning the game and scoring a lot of goals, but also getting to the goal period. But I think, yeah, I think now it's just a matter of refreshing everything and getting back to it, because obviously the next few weeks are little bit important. But yeah, I think it's just refreshing that, and hopefully the honeymoon stage is over. Now it's just reality and they need to kind of get that back to where it was from the start.
Yeah, I agree. But I guess some of the kind of the tone of the questions is like, is it something you're worried about? I mean, I guess a bit, but I mean, personally, and I know we spoke about this on the show in August or September, I mean, I always expected this. Arsenal, you know, they made a change of manager, they had a slight change of style, and that's a surprise to everyone at first. Exactly the same thing happened when Joe came in. He came in, he changed the style, and it takes teams a while to work that out. And we said on this show, we thought brilliant to have Chelsea and Manchester City kind of very early on, not least because we started our season earlier. And I think we realised that that was going to be a really big advantage, particularly the Chelsea game, coming first game of the season, when we'd already had like three competitive games by then. But that was always going to catch up with us. And I think Jonas and the players have kind of said that. And yes, injuries are starting to creep in, as we've seen. And I think that's kind of unavoidable, because you can't accuse Jonas of not rotating. He's rotated very heavily. I think the thing is as well with this style, this kind of more high pressing style, it's how Chelsea play. And if you look, Chelsea do have quite a lot of games where they, by their standards, struggle to break teams down. They had one against Leicester recently. Last season, they drew with Brighton. I think the season before, they drew with Liverpool. They have these games because sometimes when you play that counter-pressing style, if a team just sits back, you've got nothing to counter-press. And that does happen to Chelsea sometimes, but they usually find a way. That's the thing. That's just what Arsenal are going to have to do in those games. With Joe's style, you don't do, like with Joe's style, you beat all of those teams that just sit back 4 or 5 nil every single time, but you struggle in the big games. What we've got now is we've got the style to really compete and win those big games. But the payoff is sometimes against like a Kirsch, for example, who just sit in their penalty area. Sometimes that's more difficult with this style. I think the thing that makes me hopeful is the way that Vivian Miedema has been handled to this point, because we're really going to need her now. I mean, we always need her, but we're really going to need her now. And without a big player like Leah, like you look at like Leah, Kim, Viv, that's the spine. That's like the undroppable players. And we're without one of them now. But now Viv has been held back a little bit. I'm quite hopeful that, particularly with games like the Cup Final and Barcelona, that she can really propel this team forward. Because she had not, when I say she hasn't done that so far, I'm not saying she hasn't done her job, but she hasn't had to be that one-woman team, that kind of force of nature so far. But we kind of need that now, and she's had a little bit of rest. So that's one thing that makes me a little bit positive. And on the kind of left side overload, I'm not worried about that, because Man U figured it out on Sunday at half-time, and they started putting more players over there. And if you look at how the second goal comes about and our other good chances, we just overloaded the right. So, like, that's how you deal with that, frankly. But I think those are really good questions, and those are things that I've been thinking about a lot this season, about when does the honeymoon period end and how do we then readjust. A couple of questions on a different vein, from Belinda at Belinda_AWFC. The FA plan to triple attendances in the league to an average of 6,000. With Meadow Park holding 4,000, what would you like to see Arsenal do if Meadow Park ever becomes not big enough, whether it's a move to a bigger men's ground or a full-time move to the Emirates? And on a very similar vein, John Booth at John_Booth_74. Given the FA's plan to try and triple attendances, what do you think Arsenal's plans are, given Meadow Park only holds 4,000? And do you see the plan being achieved across the league? And this is, of course, a reference to the FA strategy to get the average attendance of WSL games up to 6,000.
Yeah, I think we spoke about it earlier in the season about how, you know, I think Boreham Wood is a good size for what it is now, but I do agree that we do need attendances racked up. But as we mentioned also before, is that it's really hard to find another ground in London, in particular to find the space to build something. And, you know, Boreham Wood is already a bit out of the way. So if you want to get a space, you have to go even more out of the way, which obviously is only going to hurt everything that we've built up so far. So, you know, the jump from Boreham Wood into the Emirates Stadium is big. And even if, you know, I think the priority is to get that 4K to begin with, and then you can start racking up, because I don't think we're even close to hitting that 4K week in and week out and hitting that. I mean, midday matches, you know, Champions League matches, I think it was about 1.2K or something along those lines. So, you know, we're not even halfway through filling up the stadium and regularly in the game. So I don't think Arsenal have to worry about that just yet. And yeah, just once they do, then you can start talking about different things, whether it's, you know, getting another deal with a team like Bournemouth, for example. But again, it's a big commitment for Arsenal. And if they're going to do it and they're going to commit to moving Arsenal Women, because obviously you have the academy that play there as well, it's a whole deal that they have with Bournemouth. So until they get that 4K, and I think until they're forced to, I don't think it's going to be necessary. And for the FA's plan, I think it's going to be really interesting, because obviously you have different types of grounds that can hold X amount of fans, X amount of this, but we're not seeing it yet. And until we do, you don't really have to worry about any of that. But I think they can do it. It's just a matter of if how much they're going to commit to it, how much money they're going to commit to the marketing, how much money they're going to commit to the visibility. Because I think right now, the marketing is a big issue overall in the women's game. You know, there's some games, you know, like this Arsenal Barcelona game. I mean, it's being marketed like crazy. It's being hyped up amazing. But like, you can't just do this one off every couple of months, because these games are happening, you know, every week in the Women's Super League. You know, Man United Arsenal, yes, it didn't live up to expectation, but that's a big game in the WSL. You know, Arsenal Chelsea, all these big games. You know, even like say like an Everton Brighton or a Tottenham Brighton, for example, you know, these games are good to watch, and you're not getting the same marketing for these games as you have for this Arsenal Barcelona side. You know, it is Champions League and everything, but the WSL matchups right now, especially this season, there's so many direct competitions coming in. I mean, from third to 10th, I think the point difference is no more than four off the top of my head. You know, these matchups are really good this season, and you're not seeing the marketing for the WSL at all. You know, you have Sky Sports and everything, but in everyday life, you could pretty much go about your life without knowing that the WSL even exists. So I think it's big about the marketing. But in terms of ground, yeah, I don't think Arsenal are going to be forced into changing grounds anytime soon. I think getting that 4K is going to be the first priority, as it should be. And after that, they can kind of deal with it. But yeah, I don't think it's necessary for them to move grounds just yet. And odd occasion at the Emirates. But again, marketing has to be really tight for that to be worth it.
Yeah, I think there's a few things going on here. I know from past jobs that I've done, when you do strategies like this, you set targets like that and you deliberately set them high, because you might not hit 6,000, but you might hit 4,000 trying. It's like the old saying, I think, you know, if you jump and try and hit the stars, you might not hit the stars, but you might hit the ceiling trying. So my understanding, I think the Borehamwood deal runs until 2027 for Arsenal. I don't see anything happening before that, not least because Arsenal have invested quite a lot of money in that ground. I'm very dubious as to how 6,000 is going to be is going to be achieved, given like King's Meadow holds like 4,500 as well. I think you've got like the Academy Stadium, Manchester, that holds 7,000, I think. And then you're probably relying on like Reading, who play at the Medeski. And that seems risky to me. And Leicester, who play at the King Power, like the ones who play at their men's grounds. I can only imagine, and I know there's Kelly Simmons references this in the strategy, that the average attendances so far are massaged by the games in bigger stadiums. So by like the Women's Football Weekend games. So like, I guess if you do more of those, you can bring up an average quite a bit. But I definitely think you're right about the marketing as well. I think we've become very good, just because of where the resources available, like at marketing one-off events in the women's game, but we're not good at marketing the week to week. And I think there's a lot that clubs could do locally there. Arsenal could do loads in schools in Hertfordshire, send players round to PE lessons and stuff like that. You know, send the players to like local girls' schools, you know, into PE lessons, and do like that kind of native local marketing. Get the people from the area, you know, and like say, do you know that Arsenal women are playing on Sunday? Because like when you go to Meadow Park, there's nothing that tells you, like there's not even anything at like Borehamwood Station. And that's something that Chelsea did a couple of years ago. They started putting at like Norbiton and Surbiton stations, like, you know, marketing for Chelsea women, so people knew that they played there. So like, I think in order to get some of this, like you really need to get that local kind of marketing, and we're not there yet. I don't see how 6,000 is achievable when most of the teams in the league don't have grounds of that size, unless you start putting more games in men's stadiums. But when you do that, You lose that wow factor anyway, and the attendances probably drop as a result. Whereas if you do it once in a while, you probably get big attendances. So I don't think that's really achievable at the moment. I do understand why the FA is saying that. And I think in saying that, I think their angle is, okay, we're good at marketing in the big stadiums. Now we need to market in like the normal kind of stadium, as it were, the regular stadium. But like, I'd love for more WSL grounds to be a bit like that Barcelona ground, or even Kerj's ground, lovely, by the way, in the middle of nowhere, but absolutely lovely, great facility. But they're both in the middle of nowhere. Barcelona's is right next to the airport, because that's the only place you can build. And yeah, I think it's difficult, and you can't do anything at Colney because there's no public transport there. So I think it's really, really difficult. But if we can start to get to that 3,000-4,000, yeah, I agree. Like, you only ask the question when it's like we're locking people out regularly. But there we go. Next kind of questions, again, grouping these together around the January transfer market. So we've got Teddy Mathis at Teddy Mathis 5. Do you think we need reinforcements in January? If so, in what position? And then Cameron Stewart at Cam Stewart 15. What area do you think Arsenal should strengthen during the transfer January transfer window? And Mitza as well, sorry. Mitza 90 asking basically the same question, which is, do you think we should sign anyone in January? And if so, in which position?
I forget that January is just around the corner. I don't know. That's a tricky one because I think the recruitment over the summer has been pretty decent. I think when we talked about it also, we were kind of satisfied with the positioning and everything that was brought in. I would say potentially now center backs would be the only, it would literally be the only position on the pitch that we would potentially need more players. But also I think our center backs, obviously Leah is a bad injury, but then you have Jen Beattie who is still injury prone. You know, she's come back from a lot of things and it's not in a bad way, but you know, you would like to have a backup to Jen. And then I think Lotta has needs a bit more time to be more confident in herself and her position in the team. And I say this in the sense that I think she does really good when there's someone better next to her. So when she plays next to Leah Williamson, I think it's fine because they balance out each other quite well. But then when you have Lotta and Jen, who's, you know, Jen obviously is just coming back, and you have Lotta, I think that's not the best balance that Arsenal have right now in general. I would say a center back, but obviously they're not the easiest to come by. And a high quality center back that you would need to keep up this Arsenal side. Because obviously, you know, when you have Viv, you know, scoring goals, for example, you can't really have center backs that aren't living up to the same confidence level as the attack. I think center backs would be good because obviously, you know, in every position, I would say we have two starting players in each position outside of the center backs in this given moment. But other than that, I think we're pretty decent. I'm really impressed with Zinsberger. She's stepped up to the plate quite a lot, especially when Yotis has come in. She's gotten a lot better with her feet. I'm not as I don't hold my breath whenever they pass back to follow her. And sometimes yes, but it's not as bad as it was the past couple of seasons. I think our goalkeeper situation is quite decent. You can tell both keepers have been practicing a lot with their feet, which is really promising. And yeah, you know, the wingers, the forward, obviously, you know, we still don't have a direct replacement for Viv. When you look at that number nine striker, so that could potentially be it. Just, you know, not having the alternative would be just to have a pure nine that stays in the box, poaches the balls. You know, we don't have that player because obviously Viv is that player, but also she's a player that drops back. So potentially would be, you know, the complete opposite of, we know Jonas is big on his finishing starting 11 as big as a starting 11. So if we would get a striker, that would be that really high, very, you know, I hate to say it, but like very stereotypical striker of just putting the ball in the back of the net no matter what, that could potentially be good. Those are two of the positions that I would say that we could benefit. I'm not saying we necessarily need it, but we could benefit from it a lot if we do get players in that position.
Yeah, and that's I'm going to introduce a question from Leontine Dawn as well, at Leontine Dawn on Twitter. Do you think we need a real striker as backup for Viv instead of Caitlin, Keats or Beth? I think first off, on the January transfer window, I don't think anything will be done. I would personally hold off. And the reason I would hold off is just because there are still some contractual situations coming up. And I think we need to see how they're going to shake out first. So obviously, we don't know at the moment whether Leah Williamson will extend. We don't know whether Vivian Miedema will extend. We don't know whether Jordan Nobbs will extend. I think Jen Beattie and Vicky Schneiderbeck's contracts are up at the end of the season. I believe Caitlin Ford's is up at the end of the season as well. So I think we have to know what's going to happen with some of these players before we go back into the market. I do agree with you on the centre back, though, and definitely, I think something will be done there next season because Jen Beattie and Vicky Schneiderbeck's deals are up. I would guess that Vicky's won't be renewed. Jen's might. But I think what we've got at the moment, we've got three centre-halves, very experienced, good centre-halves, but all with questionable fitness at the moment. So Jen, Vicky, Simone Boy, I'm not sure how long she signed for, actually. All good centre-backs. But, I mean, maybe A, there's a lack of speed there. at the moment overall, but maybe not so much when you've got Lotta and Leah. But I think the kind of plan was that, you know, Vicky, Jen and Simone wouldn't necessarily be relied on, or at least, you know, because they can't really play three games a week or so it seems at the moment, that the three of them would almost make two players. But now Leah's injured, that maybe exposes that situation a little bit. But I think there will definitely be some kind of centre-back coming in the summer. It also depends on how Anna Patton's seen. She's playing backup right-back at the moment, but she has been principally a centre-back in her career. And it's just a case of whether she's seen as a centre-back long-term. And if she is, then that would mean we'd need another right back. As for the striker situation, I'm personally quite relaxed about that. I do think Caitlin Ford is a decent backup striker. And she's actually been getting a lot of minutes there because Jonas has been subbing Viv and resting Viv for games. I just think trying to find that sweet spot between finding a really good striker and a striker that wants to play backup to Vivian Miedema is probably an equation that doesn't really go. I mean, if you could get, I don't know, like someone like Ellen White towards the end of their career, or like a Paulina Bremer from Wolfsburg who played that role for Man City but then wasn't happy with it and went to Wolfsburg. You know, I think it's very difficult when you've got a striker like Viv. And again, you know, we don't know if Viv is going to extend yet, so we might have to address that position on a more long-term basis, because if she goes, we're going to have to buy like a really, really good striker to replace her. So I think we need a bit more clarity there. I'm personally kind of relaxed about Caitlin and Keats as backup strikers, to be honest. I think Caitlin's played quite well during this period where Viv's been out or been rested, so I kind of think that's all right.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
But here's a question about another one of our forwards who used to be a centre forward but isn't anymore. And this is from AWFC San Antonio, who is at SWVGLord1 on Twitter. If Beth Mead continues at her current rate and still puts up the numbers, should Arsenal renew her contract or still hold out until the summer?
That's a tough one because, Tim, you alluded to it, there's so many contracts up this summer that I think a lot of it is dependent on that. And it's not just, you know, player relationships or like, you know, I want to play with Beth Mead, I want to play with Vivian Miedema, for example, and those kinds of things, but also if Viv goes, if Leo goes, you know, you have to structure a whole new, I wouldn't say style play, because the style play would be similar, but it changes so many things. And I think, you know, as much a player like Beth Mead, I would have her on my team any day of the week, you know, especially with the way she's performing this, you know, this season. Her numbers are ridiculous. And but I don't know if that's never going to be always enough to renew a contract when there's so many other factors that you have to worry about. And that's not on a football perspective. That's just, you know, on negotiations, on money, on contracts, that's out of control. But, you know, in an ideal world, you would have Beth Mead renew her contract. You would give her a new contract right away with the way she's performing. And, you know, she's so young. She can keep this up for another couple of seasons and picking up those numbers and picking up those goals. And, you know, obviously she's slotting in really well with the way that Jonas wants to play. And she's played with these players for so long that you see that chemistry on the pitch, and it's just paying off right now. But I think, yeah, in the real world, sadly, I think her contract will be dependent on a lot of things. And I think that's just the way Arsenal will be this season, as you mentioned there, Tim, about the striker and defensive and all that stuff. I think there's a lot of things in the air that have to get settled before you have a solid kind of plan going forward.
Yeah, I personally would be surprised if this isn't something that Jonas is surfacing. So I don't think there's any immediate need to extend the contract, but we know he likes playing Beth Mead, right? And it's understandable because he's moved to this high pressing style, and that really suits Beth. She's so good at that. That's like probably her number one strength is pressing and intercept. Like, she's got her interception numbers are like centre half good, basically, which is such a big weapon. And when you look at the minutes played, she's in the top five for minutes played. She's like up there with Kim. Like, he has a lot of options at wide forward, but Beth is not a player he rotates that much. And that shows you he values her. And I think she's really enjoying being at Arsenal. And I think she's really found her place at Arsenal. She's found her place in this team. Like I say, I don't think there's an immediate rush, but I wouldn't be surprised if Jonas is not already asking the question. I guess I'm implying some of the tone of this question is sometimes it's dangerous to negotiate a contract with someone at the top of their form because you want to see if that form holds. And Jonas, he referenced this actually quite nicely. He was asked about Beth a couple of weeks ago in a press conference, and he was asked about her form, and he said the kind of, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, like, the aspiration for Beth is that no one talks about her form anymore. And he kind of said, like, because she's playing like this, because she can do these things, that means she can do them. So, like, why would she be in bad form if she's this good? And it made me think of players like Kim Little, Leah Williamson. No one says, like, Leah Williamson's in great form. Like, she's reached a level of performance where people just know she's somewhere between good and brilliant all the time. Same with Viv. No one says Viv is in good form. No one says Kim Little's in good form. And so I guess you could say there's a danger about negotiating a contract and seeing, but I do think Beth has been performing at a good level for quite a long time now. And that's one. I mean, there are more urgent contracts, but I wouldn't mind seeing that at all. And like you say, she's at a great age at the moment. And one of the things I've really loved is how she's responded to the level of competition. I think that really showed that that's when you sort out who a big club player is, when you introduce that competition into their position and you see how they respond. And her response has been top class. So that to me says that what we've got here is a really top class player. So for me, why not? Let's do it. Give her the new contract. So this is a question, actually, you kind of referenced this already. It's from Ryan McGavock, who's at Ryan McFizz on Twitter. Joe always described Manu Zinsberger as world-class, but it's fair to say she split the fan base in past seasons with some of her clangers, a touch of the Almunias, ? With her established as number one, she's looked quality. Where would you rate her compared to other top goalkeepers?
Oh, don't put me in that situation. she's an interesting keeper because I wouldn't put her next to the top keepers, just because I think She does come up with a few good saves, but you know, when you compare her to a Sandra Paños, to a Cristiana Ler, I don't think she's at their level, to say it very bluntly. I do think she has improved a lot over the past year, I would say. I mean, she's come up with a lot of blunders, but she hasn't done that this season that much. You know, I'm not completely calm, but I am a lot calmer when they pass the ball back to her. She's gotten a lot better with her feet, which I think was one of her biggest problems. And when you got the ball back to her, especially under Joe, for example, who wanted to play out the back. And even under Jonas, when you still need to move the ball fairly quickly under Jonas to get the ball up and find the spaces and stuff. But she's gotten a lot better with her feet, and I respect that a lot. And I think that came when Lydia came. Lydia Williams is a very experienced keeper that can easily could have taken that number one spot, I think. And again, the way Zinsberger kind of reacted to her coming in, I think it was more professional competition than actual competition, because I think they get on really well and they both appreciate each other and they kind of push each other and they learn a lot. But I think Zinsberger has definitely learned a lot off of Lydia. I think Lydia had a lot to offer on that front, and she has improved a lot. Yeah, I wouldn't rate her against the top keepers right now, but she has improved a lot. And at the end of the day, she's still at the level to be able to play for an Arsenal side. You know, I'm not saying she's like lower tier goalkeeping. You know, she's still at the level to play for an Arsenal side, which is a pretty, really good level. But I think she has come a long way from the past couple of seasons. I'm a lot calmer when she gets the ball back to her feet and everything. And I think she's come up with really good saves this season so far. She's definitely stepped up to the challenge, and hopefully she just keeps getting better and more confident. I think confidence was also a big part of that. And she looks a lot more confident on the ball. And I think once she just, I mean, in the next year, we might be able to say the same thing of, you know, she's improved so much. You know, when you're in this competition, you know, with Chelsea and Barcelona coming up back to back, you know, she needs to step up. Like she's a very vital role against these teams that, you know, are going to attack, that know, you know, they're going to get shots on target. That's inevitable. So I think she has lived up to it, but I don't think she's one of the best in the world. I definitely don't think that, but I do rate her. And I would say I'm proud of her, the advancement that she's done. But yeah, I think she's good. She's good enough to play for an Arsenal side. So that says a lot.
Yeah, I think she's had a good 2021 overall, but I agree she's gone up another level this season. I think that's a really interesting point about Lydia and what that's done for her to have a more experienced keeper around. And look, this is stuff we'll never really know for sure, like about Lydia, or just having the confidence of being number one and not being, you know, part of that rotation so much that we saw with Joe, because that started to happen to her at the end of her time at Bayern. As well, and like frankly, I got the idea and didn't think it was a bad idea at all of Joe's, like, to rotate the goalkeepers based on what they do with their feet. I think that's kind of fine, but would you do that to Ann-Kathrin Berger? Would you do that to Christiane Endler? Probably not. You just play them because they're brilliant, and that's like, you're right. Like, I think she's gone up a level. Again, I don't know like where to pitch her in terms of like the world stage. I think in WSL terms, she's coming into that, like, you know, top three, four goalkeepers, which I wouldn't necessarily have had her at before. But I think, you know, with up there, you know, you look at the best in the division, I think, are Ellie Roebuck and Ann-Kathrin Berger. And I think like she's maybe overtaking that middle spread of goalkeepers in the middle of the league, which is where she should be. And so for Manu, I think the interesting thing is, how much does she keep improving? And it's the same as saying about Beth, like this, like, we have to stop, like, we'll know she's gone to another level when we don't talk about her form anymore. But I think you're right. There's something she's transmitting where you don't panic quite as much at the moment, and whether that's down to experience or just trust or having someone like Lydia there. What will be really interesting is what Arsenal do in the goalkeeper section in the summer, because Lydia's contract is up. I'm not convinced that that will be renewed or that she'll necessarily want to. I think she'll probably want to go back home. You know, does Fran Stenson become that second choice keeper? But she hasn't been playing a lot of football. Do we get someone else? And if we get someone else, do we get someone like Lydia again? Or, you know, at what stage does Manu become the senior goalkeeper in terms of experience? So I think that's really, really interesting. But she's another one to me who's definitely gone up a level this season. So next question, a couple of questions together, actually. And again, I think this is really, really interesting because we've just had a North London derby. I was at the Manchester United game on Sunday and there was like a de facto away end behind one of the goals, a couple of hundred Arsenal fans there. And then, of course, we saw in Kerj, thanks to Arsenal Denmark and Arsenal Sweden, we had about 500 Arsenal fans behind the goal and a proper away end. So, and this is a discussion I think that's been happening a lot on social media about the culture around women's football and how much, how sustainable it is for it to just be like a family sport. And, you know, can we keep it like that and grow the game? Can we keep getting a bit antsy if someone swears in the crowd, like without wanting it to go fully like men's football and just become really vicious and poisonous? Like, where are some of those sweet spots? So a couple of questions. First one from Ritz at Ritz767. The past few away games, the fans have sounded amazing on the broadcasts, whereas at Boreham Wood, it seems quieter. What do you think can be done to help increase the atmosphere there? And from Mohammed Makaidi Issa at JazzMaryPhy on Twitter, with fans getting louder and louder, especially in the most recent North London derby, is it time to think about having dedicated away segregation as a means to boost atmosphere and rivalry? And how sustainable is a family-friendly label for the growth of the women's game?
I think I personally would like to see that segregation of away fans and home fans, not for any other, you know, it's not obviously in the men's game. A lot of times it's because of safety. In this case, I think it would be for amplifying the support and the noise and the atmosphere. I think it's more about that, especially when we're talking about, you know, these low attendances. If you have all the Arsenal fans together, for example, if you have all the, for example, the other night at Koge, Ko had a decent following there, and it was a really good atmosphere, but they weren't sat together, so they weren't able to amplify their voice as much as they could. And they were, you know, these are like Viking people. Like they were screaming, like their voices could be heard. So if you sat them all together, that would be a whole another different atmosphere than there was there, for example. And I was sitting in the same row as Maria, and then I had all the Koga fans behind me. And obviously Maria was doing her usual chants and everything. There was a few kids in front of me that were kind of helping her around that. And this kid was loving it. And then the Koga fans will obviously, you know, yell their chants. And then at one point it got a bit cheeky and they started replicating our chants with like their own kind of things. But it was all fun and games, but that rivalry is still there. So, you know, it is possible to have a fun atmosphere without it getting, you know, being vile and violent. You know, that was a perfect example. Like there was a clear division of we're Koga fans and we're Arsenal fans. There was a clear division. There was no, like, you know, they were complaining when Arsenal were doing well, or, you know, all these things. Like there was a very clear division of what fans, what team you supported, but it wasn't nasty. It was just, you know, you get used to that rivalry, and it's a sport, you know, it's a competitive professional sport. So if you're going to these games and you're not expecting that competitiveness and that rivalry, then you need to start get used to it and start taking it a bit more seriously, perhaps. And I don't mean that in the bad way. It's just, it's a professional sport, and, you know, your Arsenal fans, whether it be long-term, short-term, but the concept is that you support the team, and then you're playing against another team that have the same kind of supporters. So you're going to clash either way. So I think it should definitely be a thing to start segregating the fans, just to amplify the voices and the atmosphere. Because as I said, you know, in the women's game, we haven't really gotten that. And you're starting to see these attendances are slowly increasing. When you have those away fans, it becomes a whole different game. Even, you know, in the Spurs game, for example, if they would have segregated all the Arsenal fans to the Spurs fans, that would have been a completely different atmosphere, I think. But it, you know, and whether it alludes to like an ugly version of, you know, whether it goes to the men's game, I think that's entirely down to the way that, I don't think that's necessarily up to the fans. I think that's the way that the game is controlled. Because, for example, in the men's game if these all these problems of racism, of all these chants, of all these things would have been handled a lot earlier at the root of it, then it wouldn't have happened. I think women's football has the advantage that we're still at the beginning of stages and everything. So everything that we do right now sets up everything that's going to happen in the future. So if we set up that friendly atmosphere of rivalries, yes, please, but don't make it ugly. You know, don't say anything, you know, to the players. Don't be, you know, don't say anything that would offend the players, that offend people next to you. You know, if we set up that precedent, if we set up that foundation now, it can lead up to a very, very good thing. And it doesn't have to turn into the men's, but you can still keep that rivalry of, hey, we scored a goal like in your face, you know, in a very nice way. But I think, yeah, I think the segregated stuff could be really good. And I don't think it has to elude. I think it's, but I think that has to be a unison kind of goal for a lot of different organizations to kind of come together and make sure that it doesn't turn into that. But I would love away ends. I think it's really fun.
Yeah, I completely agree. They're kind of happening anyway. And I know like the Chelsea Women's Supporters Group do a lot of work around this. Usually they just kind of say, well, let's all buy tickets in the same area. And I know the Arsenal Women's Supporters Club do this like that, and that's what happened at Man United, right? Like it wasn't by accident that a couple of hundred Arsenal fans ended up in the same area. it's just like it was choreographed to some extent. So what that tells you as well is that the fans want this, and you're right, it's not about it's not about safety reasons. Like there isn't like a line of stewards or anything. Like I don't think that's needed. I don't think anyone's going to throw bottles at each other or anything. It is about just sitting together and getting those songs going. And what was great about that at Man United on Sunday is, you know, United, they have fans that sit together and sing songs and stuff like that. And they all sit together, like, it's for that reason, because they're like-minded and they want to get that kind of going. And you get great things like, you know, I love the chant, she's red, she's white, she loves the Vegemite for Caitlin Ford. Like, just stuff like that we don't get enough of in the women's game. I personally, like, I'm not worried about it becoming like the men's game or that toxicity coming into it, because I think the people, certainly that I observe, that are responsible for that at men's football, they're not coming to women's football anytime soon. Like, they're just not, okay? Like, those types of people, I don't think they're going to be turning up at Meadow Park. They're going to be like the last people to come to women's football, I think. So like I'm not too worried about that. And on the kind of is the family friendly thing sustainable, I think it is, because like, but it doesn't have to be just families. Like, we know we're talking about segregation, like of away fans and things like that. You can easily have a family enclosure as well. And it can be bigger than the one, like proportionally, than the one at the Emirates, because the one at the Emirates is like quite small. You can make a whole stand like the family enclosure at Meadow Park or other grounds or something like that, because it's more family. And that's not to say that if you're families, you have to sit there. It's just like an option, almost like, I don't know, like the quiet carriage on a train or something like that. Which is not to say that like families would definitely be quiet and not join in with the atmosphere or anything. But I think we are going to have to get to this stage where there's atmosphere created, and there is a bit of a payoff with that. And of course, the thing is with atmosphere as well, like a couple of people who've asked this question, you know, they're watching on broadcasts, and the fans are a big part of that. And one of the things I think where women's football suffers as a product is the lack of like noise, basically, because what you want is you want like for it to matter. So if you've got like an engaged set of fans while you're watching it on TV as well, like, wonderful. That is all part of it. That is just as big a part of selling the quote-unquote product as the players on the pitch. Like, hearing people celebrating, hearing people singing player songs. And that gets people going, because I think what we've got as well is a bit of a standoff between, you know, like, Sky are looking for times to broadcast these games at good times, and there is a tension there, because the best time to televise a game is not necessarily the best time for fans to go. And you know, we're talking earlier about attendances, and how much does increased TV coverage have an impact on that, and some of the scheduling, because Like Sky have to do that because if they put it on Sunday at 3 o'clock, it's going to clash with a Premier League game and it's going to hit the audience. So there's lots of these factors, but I think a massive selling point would be like better atmosphere, you know, segregation of away fans. Away fans are doing that anyway. They're segregating themselves. They're getting together. So why not just make it easier for them? I think that's one of, even before we start thinking about the numbers, like that for me is like the next big challenge for like to create a little bit of atmosphere at some of these games. And I think if you do that, you attract people to come to the games anyway, because you make them believe, oh, wow, if I go there, you know, that's going to be fun. I know people who went to Kirsch who don't usually go, who then went to Man United on Sunday because they were like, wow, that was really nice to be part of, like, you know, to be part of something there. So, yeah, sorry, that was quite a long answer, but it's something I've thought about a lot, especially since that game in Denmark, which I loved. I loved seeing that, like, that big away crowd. Couple of questions to finish off. This one, actually, sorry, I think I got the individual's name wrong who asked the last question, Mohammed. Mohammed actually asked this question, a more tactical one. What do you think of our left-hand side when we play Catley and McCabe together? For me, I think McCabe is more effective at left-back, which gives her the drive to overload. Catley, for me, sometimes slows the build-up and can be one-dimensional. I think she is more effective from deep, i.e. left centre-back.
That's a bit of a hard one. I do agree that McCabe and Catley still have a lot of adjustment to do to kind of get used to playing together. I do think Steph Catley is the kind of player that has the ability to go up and attack. Whether I think she's been doing it particularly smoothly enough with Katie McCabe, I don't think so. But I think that's just down to they haven't played together that many times. You know, we've mentioned about the rotation. You know, sometimes it's Beth, sometimes it's Katie, sometimes it's Caitlin. You know, there's different left wing options that I don't think they've played enough together for it to be kind of very fluid. And at the same time, I think the teams that you would want to see it against, I don't think Steph Catley would have as much freedom to go up as you would want her to. So for example, you know, against a team like Chelsea, against a team like Barcelona, if Steph Catley leaves that space, they will exploit that off their first touch once they get possession back. So I think it's a mix of everything, but down the left hand, I think I do personally like Katie McCabe as left back and then Beth Mead on the left. I think that's our most kind of efficient attacking formation on that left side. And I think that's just down to chemistry. I think Beth and Katie have a great chemistry on and off the pitch. Steph Catley doesn't have that yet with Katie on the pitch. And I think that's affecting it just a little bit of living up to the complete potential that it could be. And yeah, of course, you know, Steph Catley has played center back a couple times, and potentially that could suit her a bit more because she does have, you know, a banging left foot to ping out across pitch long balls. I would be interested actually to see her play in that position just to see what she can do, because I think she has a very similar style of confidence on the ball as Leah Williamson in terms of taking the space forward and then pinging that over with absolutely no problem. And we all know what she can do with her left foot. I mean, you saw that free kick that she did. You know, it was perfect in every angle. So it should be interesting, but I think based on where they are now in their chemistry on the pitch, I think Katie McCabe, Beth Mead is kind of the best combination on down the left side. Though I do really enjoy Katie playing on the wing. I think she brings a lot because if you're doing this high press, she's obviously a defender. So she knows how to close that down. And if you have an even better defender behind her, you know, that's just going to be a double whamming on the high press. So I think this high press does suit KE a lot on the wing. But I think she can do just as much damage as she does fullback. So I would say, yeah, Beth and KE would be my go-to, but I would say give Steph Catley time. And I think she'll live up to that expectation that we all have of her.
Yeah, prior to Sunday, I kind of agree that the Catley McCabe thing hadn't quite worked on the left, just because they're very similar players and they like to attack the same spaces. And really what you want is one to come inside and one to overlap. And I think we saw in the Everton game, Katie played left back and Tobin played on the left. And I think that's got a lot of potential. But likewise, I think Tobin and Catley would have a lot of potential because Tobin comes inside a little bit more on her right foot. I think you get that natural overlap. I do think, well, at least I hope, I think there was a bit of a breakthrough against United on Sunday. I thought it really worked against United. And actually, it's more of a triangle over there. So you have Catley and McCabe, and then usually Frieda Marnham kind of comes over and they make a little triangle. And that's that triangle that's really, really interesting. So I kind of agree until Sunday that I don't think it had been brilliant, but I thought it was brilliant on Sunday. And I really hope that that's just because they've done it a few times. But I'm really interested to see when Tobin comes back in, because I think Tobin with either one of those left backs on the overlap could be really, really dangerous. Or Manor as well, because Manor comes inside as well. And I think those are two players who, when they come back from injury, could freshen this team up a little bit. And, you know, had some questions about whether the honeymoon period's over, whether people have worked us out. Like, I do think if we can get Tobin and or Manor back into the team, we can do something a little bit different with those players. Final two questions. This one from Yana at YanaDW_. We almost never play with the same midfield two games in a row, and I feel like it's affecting the team. I know Jonas likes to rotate, but it seems that he hasn't figured out his preferred midfield yet. Do you think there's a bit too much rotation in that area?
I think saying that he hasn't figured out his best midfield is a bit misleading. Just because I think he's smart enough to know what his best midfield is. Now, he's not going to use that every single game, just like Joe did, for example. Joe is the kind of man that you would predict to start in 11. I think Jonas is a bit more flexible in the fact that he prioritizes, he knows every single player's individual strengths and what they can do, what they can do, what it's not even what they can do, because I think everyone can do everything, but a matter of who does it better and who can fit the more tactical approach to every team. So I don't think it's about playing a steady midfield throughout the team, because we've talked about it before, you know, Frieda Manum, Leovalti, Kim Little, Jordan Knobbs, Manu Babucci, you know, they all have a very, 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 very different style of play when you look at them individually. Now, I think they're all good enough to be able to adjust to different, having different players on the pitch in that midfield. I think they're all experienced enough. I think, you know, Frieda Manum would probably be the youngest out of all of them. So when you have Kim Little, Leovalti, you know, Jordan Knobbs, even Mana is already a really experienced player at a high level. These players are good enough to be able to adjust to that. And I think if Jonas has implemented that from the start, that he will pick the starting 11 based on what he wants to do. And if he explains that to players, I think that's completely okay. I don't think playing different midfields will have a big of an effect as it will do if it's perhaps, you know, different, if it's just a coach rotating players without any really, you know, style of play or very vision, or if the manager doesn't really tell the players why they're switching. And I think Jonas is a very straightforward person that he would explain every single game why you're getting picked and why you're not getting picked, for example. So I think the player rotation in the midfield shouldn't affect Arsenal that much in theory. Is it? Maybe a little bit. But at the end of the day, I don't think it will be a big problem in the long run. I think players have adjusted really well to Jonas' style of play, and they know what he expects from them. You know, he mentioned if you want to be more defensive, play Leovalti. If you want to be more attacking, you play Frieda Manum, Kim Little, for example, Mana for... just to put another one, you know, these midfield players are very experienced, very professional players that they know what is expected of them. And as long as that continues to happen, I don't think it should be a problem. I think our midfield is probably one of the strongest on what we have, just because of the different styles of players and how much we can adjust to the other team. And I'm not saying that's a priority, but it is a big factor when you're looking at playing different styles of team in different competitions. It's big. So no, I don't think the rotation in the midfield has been a big impact. It can be, yes, because that's just, you know, players are human beings and, you know, change and obviously when they're comfortable, they're comfortable. When there's change happening, it could maybe throw them off a little bit. But they are professional players, and I think everyone knows what's expected of them. And I think they've all kind of given into that to a certain extent. Obviously, I can't really say individually how much the players love Jonas and whatnot, but I think it should be fine. The rotation in the midfield is more down to tactical approaches to the opposition.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I think there's a trade-off here. I do think there'd be a value in having a more regular midfield, but then you're leaving out one really good midfielder quite a lot. And with the kind of the game load as well that we've got, I think rotation is necessary. So I think there is a bit of a trade-off. I think there's two things I'll add to this answer. One that's really interesting to me is Leovolti was rotated a lot more, but she started earlier in the season. She started the last four games now. I think a lot of that is to do with the absence of Leah Williamson. I think without Leah Williamson, Leovolti's distribution from that area of the pitch becomes more important. So I'd say she will be rotated a bit less in the kind of upcoming period until Leah Williamson's back. The other thing, I mean, for me, I still think Jordan Nobbs should play more. And actually, I guess my answer would be I think the midfield should rotate a bit more. And the reason for this is I don't think Jordan Nobbs is getting enough minutes. And Kim Little's played more minutes than any other player this season. And I get that. Like, Kim's a really important player and she's the captain. But I would still maybe rotate her more often than Jonas does to get Jordan in there. And actually to get them in there together, I do think... you know, they've played together for so long. So I'd like to see Jordan play more because I think Jordan's quality has just kind of been forgotten about a little bit because of injuries. And I'd really like to see her get more of a run because I think if you give Jordan four or five games in a row, you'd look at her and go, yeah, she's as good as Kim Little is. She's a different player, but she's as good. And I do believe that. And then you start thinking, yeah, maybe I rotate her less. And then I think it's about what happens behind them between Leovolti and Frieda Marnham. That would be my tweak, personally. I guess I'm saying maybe I rate Jordan Nobbs more highly than Jonas Eideveld does, which is not to say Jonas Eideveld doesn't rate her because he does play her, he rotates her in and out. But I think Arsenal are always better with Jordan in the team, personally. But that's just me. Let's finish on this one. I think this is a really good question to finish on quickly from Ben Harrop at Ben_Harrop1. A question for all of you, please. Which player has impressed you most this season?
Frieda Marnham. That was quite easy. I mean, I think we have, you know, a really, really, really good squad. But in terms of, and maybe it was because I didn't know much about Frieda Marnham before. And she kind of came in and she's like, yeah, this is me. This is how good I am. But it's she's really impressed me in how confident she is for a very young player. Her ball skills are ridiculous. Her confidence take on players is amazing. And her calmness on top of everything is ridiculous. You know, it's that calmness and that confidence put together that is a really rarity of a find. And in her position, you know, that midfield position is a really hard position to be really good at. And she's done that so easily. And I think on top of everything, the way she's affected the Arsenal attack has been really positive. It's only been positive. And obviously we mentioned, you know, her rotating with Leovolti, and it's just everything put together between the confidence, the calmness, the ball skills, the everything put together. I mean, she's been amazing for Arsenal. That's the only way I can put it. And when you look at her age, you know, if Arsenal take this seriously, she can become an Arsenal player to the core. If they use her properly, if they, you know, build on that whole thing, she can be here for a long time and she can have that positive impact like a Kim Little, like a Leon Tim, like Jordan Nobbs. You know, she can have a really, really positive impact and become a really big part of the team. I think, you know, obviously there's other players that I can talk about, but I think Frieda Marnham has been my biggest standout performer of a newbie coming in. She's blown me away and she's easily become, you know, one of my top players in Europe at the moment, just because she has a lot of characteristics that are really hard to come by. And she's nailed it down at such a young age, and she's really impressed me so far, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely impressed me as well. I think a few names come to mind. I mean, we mentioned Manu Zinsberger, we've spoken about Beth Mead. Leah Williamson, I think, has gone to another level this season. I think she's hit world-class bracket, you know, maybe top three in her position in the world. But the player that I'm going to say, because we were asked just before the season started, who's going to be the McCabe of this season? And I said Noel Maritz, and I think Noel Maritz has been outstanding. She's been everything you want in a right back, which is like 7 or 8 out of 10 every week. And I think that job, her understanding of her job as well, where Arsenal do kind of have a left-sided bias when they go forward, and she kind of tucks in a little bit, almost like that third centre half at times, but like, you know, getting up on the overlap and supporting Beth in particular on that right-hand side, I think she's built a really strong connection with her. And Noel Maritz is just someone, you know, if a ball breaks down her side, like my blood pressure goes down a little bit, you know, a bit like when Kim Little gets the ball and you go, she's not going to lose it, it's fine. I kind of feel the same with Noel Maritz, and, you know, she's taken on this season already, you know, someone like Lauren Hemp. I don't think anyone's done a better job on Lauren Hemp than her. She was up against Leah Galton on Sunday, who's a fabulous winger, really difficult to deal with. No problem at all. I can't really think of a goal we've conceded down her side, or a time I've thought, ooh, you were a bit out of position there. Like, just close to faultless, actually. And she's another one of the players. There aren't many players that don't rotate out of the team, but she's one of them. I think she played 7 games in a row recently before she got a rest against Kerch. In the home game, and I think that tells you a lot about how Jonas sees her as well. And I'm delighted that we're seeing the best of her now, because I was so excited when we signed her last season, and I was trying to say to people, we've signed one of Wolfsburg's starting wing backs. Like, this is big, and she was, you know, she was injured and a little bit in and out of the team, but for me, she's impressed me. I think the most actually this season. So definitely shout for Noel Maritz. But anyway, that, speaking of Noel Maritz, actually, she's going to be on the podcast next week. Remember that, alongside Steph Catley, and we'll have Chelsea perspective ahead of the FA Cup final at Wembley on Sunday, the 5th of December. And then we will have a Barcelona preview pod featuring Lotta Wubben-Moy. And that will be out on Tuesday, the 7th of December. So plenty of audio content coming your way. And obviously we'll have all the usual written stuff on the site, the videos we've started doing now post-match. And obviously we'll do all of that at Wembley and at the Emirates as well. So stick with Arseblog News. And thank you so much for all of your questions and your interactions, etc., etc. We're really, really happy with the quality of questions that come in, and that's why we do this mailbag. I must admit, the first time we did it, we kind of thought, okay, let's see what comes in. But honestly, the quality and the variety of questions is so good that we can make a show of over an hour with no problem. And to be honest, they're quite low maintenance for us as well. So thank you for helping us to create that content. But Alex, thanks very much for your time and your insights as ever.
No, pleasure as always. I'm looking forward to the next few weeks.
And obviously you can follow Alex, and you should follow Alex on Twitter at AlexIbaceta23. I nearly said 123. I always nearly say 123, but 23 on Twitter. And obviously we'll be back next Wednesday with that pre-FA Cup final preview show. But until then, take care of yourselves and adios.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.